Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Appreciate having you with us. And, you know, probably even on your best day, you sometimes will have some anxious thoughts, especially with what's been going on in the world right now. And we're going to take a look at a philosophy that is centuries old and see if it can help you and I find some peace of mind. Our guest is Nicholas Bomarito. He is an author and assistant professor in the philosophy department at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver. His latest book is titled Seeing Clearly, A Buddhist Guide to Life. So as we talk with him, what questions do you have about Buddhism? Have you used any of the practices to help you deal with your life and your worries? Love to hear from you. Give us a call at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Nicholas Bomarito, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Oh, I'm not hearing Nicholas. Nicholas, are you there? Everybody else may be hearing him except me. I'm not sure. Okay, so we're having some problems getting Nicholas on the line, and so while we're doing that, we'll take a look at kind of what he will be talking about. There were some ancient philosophers that concluded that what matters to living well was not just what we thought, but how we thought, and not just how we thought, but how we responded to the world and to other people. And actually, there's a whole series of books coming out from Oxford University Press that highlight some of the perhaps transformative ideas that these philosophers have about this. And the book series is dedicated to the idea that philosophy can be more than an academic discipline, can be a way of life. And the book in that series that we're talking about today looks at one way to do that. Again, the book title is Seeing Clearly, A Buddhist Guide to Life. And the author is our guest today, and I think we have him on now, Nicholas Bomarito. Nicholas, an assistant professor in the philosophy department at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, our guest. Nicholas, we got you there. Welcome.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes. I can hear you now.
Hi.
A little anxious thought of my own there while I was waiting to
nice
get you in.
Anticipation.
Well, how did you get interested in Buddhism?
You know, so when I was raised Catholic, I'm from an Italian Catholic family, and around the time I was getting my confirmation, I just felt like I wasn't really feeling it. I was just going through the motions, and so I just started reading. It hadn't occurred to me that someone could not be a religion, so I just thought, oh, there must be some other religion for me, so I started reading around in different religions, you know, Islam, Sikhism, you know, all Judaism, all this stuff. And I just started reading. I read a book called The Way of the Bodhisattva by Shantideva. And it, you know, really kind of resonated with me. And so then I just was interested in it. And then it sort of deepened when I went to college at University of Michigan. And it's kind of unromantic, but I saw a poster that said, hey, you could study in Tibet. And I said, okay. And so then I studied in Tibet and just met a lot of people and you know, so got interested in it that way by sort of having more contact with people.
How do you think it's changed your life?
I think it's made, I'm a kind of worrier by nature. So it's helped me have better perspective on that, and it's helped me deal with frustrating people and situations in a kind of different way. So for me, it was a good framework for changing my outlook in that way.
One of the things I liked or enjoyed right off the bat, you say in the book that you're not trying to turn all the readers into Buddhists. What are you trying to do?
I guess when I thought of the book, you know, the editor Stephen Grimm sort of asked me to write the book, and initially I said, no, I'm not interested, because I kind of felt like there's so many books on Buddhism, you know, it's like we don't need another one or whatever. But then I started thinking, and I, you know, a lot of them are written by Buddhists from a particular sect, and they're giving that kind of perspective. And I kind of wanted to write something that was would make Buddhism understandable and familiar, even if someone, you know, didn't accept it. They would say, oh, okay, I sort of get what the idea is and why they're doing what they're doing. And I was particularly, you know, so there's a lot of books on Buddhist philosophy, but they usually don't talk about the actual practices that Buddhists do. And there's a lot of books on Buddhist practices, but they usually don't talk too much about Buddhist philosophy. And for me, they're always kind of really deeply intertwined. So I wanted to write something that would sort of present them both as a kind of coherent whole without saying, this, accept this. It's just kind of I want it to be an invitation to be like, hey, this is how a lot of people are thinking about things. So, like, think about it for yourself and see what seems right or wrong as a kind of invitation to engage with it.
Yeah. And there's not just one Buddhism, is there? It reminded me a little bit of Christian society, where we have a great number of religions relating to Christianity, and the same goes for Buddhism, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and it's like any religion. I think Christianity is a great example, where it's like even particular people relate to Christianity in a different way. Like when I, as I mentioned before, I was having all this religious skepticism about my Catholicism, and a lot of people in my family had this thing of like, you're taking this way too seriously. Just show up, put your money in the tray, kneel, and then go home. Like, why are you so worried about it? So that's one way to relate to it. And some people relate to Buddhism that way. It's like, oh, we stop by, we put some incense, and then, you know, we go. So that's like one way. And, you know, other people relate to Christianity because, like, it gives them a framework to, like, hate certain groups of people. You know, some people relate to it because it gives them a really supportive community. Some people relate it to it in a more spiritual way. So it's like, even just different sects of Buddhism aside, people relate to it in really different ways too.
Yeah, and it's a very, I think it kind of, it's a complex philosophy, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's again, like with Christianity, it's like, you know, the theologians at Notre Dame think about God in a certain way. And like my grandmother thought about God in a different way. And, you know, talking to those two people, they're really different ways of thinking about God, you know, like, so a theologian might be like, oh, God is the ground of all being, and, you know, and like for my grandma, it's like, God's a big man in the sky who writes down everything you do, or, you know, like,
Nicholas Bomarito, our guest today, his book is titled Seeing Clearly, A Buddhist Guide to Life. And he is going to be with us right up until 12:30 today, but we need to take a quick look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and certainly invite you to join in. What questions do you have or experiences do you have that relate to this? Give a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email us your thoughts at ideas@wpr.org. Take a quick look at the news, and then we'll be back with Nicholas Bomarito, author of Seeing Clearly, A Buddhist Guide to Life. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for being with us today. I really appreciate it. Our guest, for your listening pleasure, is Nicholas Mammarito. He is an author and assistant professor in the philosophy department at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver. Talking with him about his latest book, it's titled Seeing Clearly, A Buddhist Guide to Life. So, what helps you deal with anxiety and worry? Have you tried practices like meditation, for example, or mindfulness? Have they helped? We'd love to hear from you. You can become a part of the conversation by calling us at 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Let's go back to these sort of the origins of the philosophy. And by the way, I have to say that you're a really good writer, Nicholas.
Thank you.
And even I was able to understand and follow in a very entertaining way. What you were getting at in your book. But I was kind of struck by your story about the first Buddha. And you want to give us a thumbnail on the first Buddha?
Yeah, basically, we say the historical Buddha, meaning the one that was in Nepal and India a few thousand years ago. But basically, he's born and there's a kind of fortune teller says, oh, he's either going to be a really prominent politician ruler, or he's going to be have really deep, like kind of religious spiritual insights. And, you know, his dad is a ruler, so he wants him to be a ruler. So he kind of keeps him in the palace and in a life of luxury. And he sort of grows up that way. But then sort of one day he leaves the palace and he sees what are called the four sights. So he's a sick person. What's wrong with that person? And the person says, oh, sometimes people get sick, right? He sees an old person. He says, what's up with that person? He says, well, sometimes people get really old. He sees a corpse, and he says, what's that? And he says, well, that's a dead person. Some people die, you know. And he's really shaken by this. And then finally he sees a kind of religious practitioner, someone who kind of renounces certain parts of worldly life, who seems really calm, even though all of this stuff is going on. And then that sort of changes something in him. And then he leaves, he sort of renounces, he leaves his rich life and tries to figure out how to deal with these harsh realities. And then the rest of his life and teachings is how he managed to deal with them, is the kind of thumbnail.
And I guess, the underpinnings then of the basic philosophy of Buddhism, correct?
Yeah, and it's philosophical in the sense that it's sort of describing reality in a way that's not exactly apparent. So it's like reality isn't exactly how it seems, but it's also practical in that it's a solution to a practical problem. Like there's this, things happen in life that we don't want to happen, and we have to deal with them. And so it's a solution for how to face those things without just denying them or ignoring them, but how to, like, take them head on.
Yeah, and, you know, people get sick, people die, people cheat, people steal, people lie, I think. And you're saying, go ahead.
Sometimes people, I think Buddhism gets a bad rap in that people focus on the confrontation of the problem. And so people think Buddhism is kind of pessimistic. They say, oh, Buddhists think life is suffering, this and that. And that's true. But, you know, the other half of that is they think it's kind of solvable, which is quite optimistic.
It is indeed. Well, you write that we are all obsessed with ourselves.
Well, yeah, and the way it's like we experience life in subtle ways that relate it to ourselves, in that I hear about, you know, the news break we just had. You might hear about, oh, there's a hurricane somewhere. You say, well, you know, I don't really know anyone there. I don't live there. So I might be like, oh, that's too bad. And then I just go about my day, right? Whereas if I, mm-hmm. you know, if I have a house there or if I have a relative there, then I'm really worried, right? So even in that kind of way of experiencing things, we sort of relate it to ourselves. And I think it's important to keep in mind that being obsessed with yourself in this way, or being kind of self-centered in this way, isn't always like you think you're great. Like, I always think of Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh. Like, Eeyore's kind of like really sad. But anything that happens, to be like, oh, you know, I'm not as good as that other person. Like, even when something happens, it's kind of like in a negative way related to Eeyore. He experiences everything that happens, he experiences like more evidence that Eeyore is not good, right? Which is a different way of being kind of self-centered, not in the, you know, kind of prideful way. But that's still like, if so, and in that sense, you, when you see an Eeyore, you're like, hey, let go of that. It's not about you. It's just like something good happened to Piglet. Just be happy for Piglet. It doesn't, it's, you know.
Oh my goodness, me. Well, the maybe before we go any farther, we should have you explain your book, how it's set up. It really divided into two parts, as you talked about earlier, the philosophy and the practice.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, so that's exactly right. So it starts with a little bit of the history and the kind of motivation. But the first half is really the ideas of Buddhism, that is how they think the world is. Because the fundamental problem, why we kind of suffer, is supposed to be that we don't, on a kind of very visceral level, we don't get how reality really is. We miss experience it. And so the first half is an explanation for how the world is from a Buddhist point of view. And, you know, there's not one Buddhist point of view, but sort of the general kind of disputes and issues that Buddhists think about when they're trying to figure out how reality is. And then the second half is a wide range of practices that exist in the Buddhist world. Again, that no Buddhist does all of them, but I just try to give you a wide range of different things that Buddhists do, and then why they do them in light of how they think the world is. So they do them in order to kind of get used to how the world is. So, yeah, as I said, most of my experience is from Tibetan Buddhism, although I have some experience with other Buddhist schools. But the Tibetan word that gets translated as meditation also colloquially means getting used to. So if you move to a cold climate, you say, oh, don't you think the winters are really cold? You say, oh, I got used to it. There, that's the same word for meditation. So when you're meditating, you're getting used to how reality really is. So I talk about a wide range of practices that involve getting used to the way the world is, that the way we saw in the first half. So those are the way I think they fit together.
Well, you even use Mickey Mouse. When you're talking about, I think the two truths, right?
Yeah. So they're basically, it's like we say things are true, but sometimes we say they're true within a set of conventions or assumptions. So if you say, well, what happened in this Mickey Mouse cartoon? You might say, oh, Mickey met Minnie and they fell in love or whatever. And that's true in a certain way. But in another way, it's like, no, it's just a cartoon. There's no Mickey. There's no Minnie. They're not real. Mickey didn't do anything. He doesn't feel any emotions. None of that's true. So it's true within a kind of system of conventions that there are characters and events happen and they have emotions. But from another point of view, none of that's true, right? So that's a kind of important concept in certain schools of Buddhism, to make sense of our everyday talk versus the radically different way that they think reality is.
Bonnie emailed that during cancer treatment, she took a meditation class at her health area, and she said it helped her immensely. You mentioned meditation. Does meditation, does it help you?
Yeah, like anything, it's like I go through phases where I'm better about doing it or I need it more. But yeah, and one of the things I try to explain in the book is I try not to talk about meditation as one thing. I try to talk about a bunch of specific techniques within Buddhism that you might call meditation. So a popular one is mindfulness, but there's also like meditation techniques that involve imagining certain things, like vividly imagining certain things to sort of train your reactions. So I sort of talk about that. But yeah, there's a lot of different kinds of meditation. And I think partly it's important to keep that diversity in mind because you might try one and be like, it didn't really do anything. But that doesn't mean like maybe that wasn't the right technique for you.
Yeah, that makes sense.
For the problems that you're facing right there.
Ron in Madison has a question, I believe. Let's go there. Ron, hi. Thanks for calling.
Thanks. What percent of Buddhists worldwide are peace activists? A little bit of background. In 79, I met a member of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship in Honolulu. And then in 82, I spent many weeks marching, walking, talking, living with a small order of Buddhist monks and nuns, which had been founded right after the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings. And so I have a very distorted experience because almost all Buddhists I ever met were peace activists. But in recent years, I heard about this Buddhist monk in Burma, Myanmar, who was the key instigator of the atrocities against the Muslim Rohingya minority. And so I'm wondering, you know, trying to get a broader perspective of Buddhism worldwide.
Okay.
Yeah. That's great that you're sort of counterbalancing an ideal image with kind of uncomfortable realities. So yeah, definitely a lot of Buddhists are kind of peace activists. So Thich Nhat Hanh is famously kind of more political activist for peace. In India, the Dalit movement it has a lot of activists in Buddhism. And like you said, there's a lot of Buddhists who are sort of less than ideal in that sense. And that also has a lot of historical precedent. So in China and Japan, a lot of military generals would claim to be incarnations of bodhisattvas. For a long time in Tibet, basically whatever Buddhist sect was closest with the Mongols was who was in charge, and then they would have to kind of step around. You know, the Mongols are were doing a lot of war and sort of awful stuff. But so there's a Tibetan Buddhist named Sakya Pandita who this sort of his Mongol patron sort of asked him, is it wrong to kill in battle? And you can see him kind of trying to walk a line of like, he doesn't want to lose his political support, but he doesn't want to kind of endorse that. So he says like, well, if you must fight, you should fight bravely or something, you know, which is a kind of really hedged answer. So I think I try not to be super romantic about Buddhism. And it's true. It's like, it's motivated a lot of people to do a lot of great things, but it's also been used by a lot of people to do a lot of terrible things.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's just a mixed bag like anything else.
We use the word mindfulness. That term comes up all the time. What does it mean in Buddhist practice?
So there it translates a pair of terms that basically means fixing your mind on something and keeping it there. So the Tibetan term often means something like memory, which is pretty different from how we think of mindfulness as like being in the moment. But you have to kind of stay in a succession of moments. So some people translate it even as retention. But basically the idea is like, you want to be able to focus your mind on something and keep it there, because that's a very important and like kind of fundamental mental skill to do other things. So I sometimes think about it like, even if you want to solve some other problem, like say you want to solve a relationship problem, or say you want to fix a broken step in your house, you have to be able to focus your mind on it and keep it there. If you keep getting distracted by everything that comes up, you're never going to be able to solve the problem. So a big part of that is training that kind of mental skill. And it turns out if you try to do mindfulness meditation, it's quite hard. Like if you try to sit there and just keep your attention fixed on your breathing, your attention doesn't want to stay there. It wants to rove around. There's a lot of Buddhist metaphors about, you know, the conscious mind is kind of like a crazed monkey that's just running wild everywhere. And, you know, if you do it more, you can kind of get better at it. So I think the heart of mindfulness training is getting better at doing that with your conscious mind.
Do prayer beads help? A Vern called to ask if you can discuss the reasons behind the 108 Buddhist prayer beads.
Yeah, I mean, 108 is just, even outside of Buddhism, that's like the right number. It's like a good number, you know. So there's some numbers that are just have a kind of importance. So 84,000 is one, 108 is another. But it would be kind of like, you know, like in the West, for a while we really thought seven was really important. So we thought at a certain point in our history, we thought, oh, there needs to be seven colors and seven planets, because like that's just the right number. I think more practically, when I've done things with beads, I think there is something that's very important in the kind of tactile feel of it, of like focusing, like a sort of acknowledgement that you're not just a mind, you're also a body. And so doing something with your body can also help your mind. Another case with this is there's a Buddhist practice of prostration, which is you basically lower your body down in front of a representation of the Buddha or a group of texts, you know, books or something. And I think part of what's really powerful about that is like your physical body posture affects your outlook. So I was thinking of, in the book, I talk about an example of like, sometimes you go out for dinner and one person sits in a seat that's lower than the other people, and they kind of feel like a kid at the table. And I think that really affects how the conversation goes, or like the dynamics of, you know, which jokes get laughed at or which suggestions get taken seriously. So I think sometimes people ignore this. Certainly I did as a philosopher for a long time, because I'm really thinking about ideas and stuff like that. But I think that a lot of these, the physicality involves a kind of tacit acknowledgement that we're bodies as well as mind.
Yeah. Well, there, you know, here we're getting close to the end, a few more minutes to go, but I'm thinking about the various chapters in the book, the second half of the book, Solitude and Meditation, Mindfulness and Breathing, Mindfulness and Death, and Kindness and Joy. That struck me.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of training in the Winnie the Pooh example I kind of mentioned earlier. It's like, and I think that's particularly important nowadays, because we have, you know, a lot of people have social media, and it's like, you don't need social media for this, but it really ramps it up. It's like someone goes on a vacation, they come back with all these wonderful photos, and you can kind of feel like, oh, screw them in their stupid vacation, whatever. But if you know, the idea is that there are ways to train that habit out of you. That's a habit like any other habit. And if you can sort of overwrite other habits, you don't have to be kind of super new agey to just be like, oh, you know, like good for them. They had a really nice vacation. I'm really happy for them. I'm genuinely just happy that something good happened to them. And like trying to cultivate that kind of habit rather than the other one.
And I loved your chapter on get over yourself.
Yeah. 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 And that's in a certain way, that's I think, the heart of a lot of different strands in Buddhism. That is like when I see someone showing me their vacation photos, or when they're talking about something they think or something they like or whatever, it's not really about me at all. And I just am tempted to experience it as, well, I don't agree with that. Oh, I wish I went on that, whatever. And it's just kind of like, well, there's a way of, like, maybe I could just give that up. It's hard to do. It's really hard. I wish I could do it, but, you know, you can get better at it.
You can get better at it. And I think you do a very nice job in the book at talking about how we can get better at it. And we really haven't gotten into the nuts and bolts of that part. But I tell you what, Nick, it's been a lot of fun talking with you today. Thank you so much taking time to be with us today. It's a fascinating book that I think any of our listeners are going to enjoy. And I appreciate you being with us. Thanks.
Thank you. Take care.
Take care. Nicholas Bomarito's book is titled Seeing Clearly, A Buddhist Guide to Life. It's published by Oxford University Press, part of a series of books coming out from Oxford on philosophy and how we can apply it, how you and I can apply it to our daily lives, whether we, as he said, you don't have to take all of it, but you pick the parts that work for you and use them. Well, I tell you what, tomorrow Liz Freemuth, I believe, joins us for another edition of Garden Talk. In the meantime, I hope you'll stay with us, because there's lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.